This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, this is Enterprise. My name is Audrey Raj. Now, most managers start their career at the operational level, but as they advance further in the organization, their leadership competencies too need to evolve to take on a more strategic focus. What's the difference between operational leadership and strategic leadership? Well, on the show today, we have Dr. Rozan Othman, author of the book, Getting Ahead, Developing Competencies for Strategic Leadership. And we're about to discuss why strategic leadership is essential today using case studies from Asian and Western cultures.
Okay, good morning. I am Rozan Othman. I'm the senior partner at Human Capital Development. Sundaram Berhad, we are a management consulting firm, and I've authored this book titled Getting Ahead, Developing Competencies for Strategic Leadership.
So, Dr. Rozan, what compelled you to write this book? Did you think there was a need to address competencies in leadership today?
Okay, basically, part of the trigger that led me to start thinking about this issue was when I was doing my research earlier when I was in one of the universities looking at the issue of talent management in organizations. And one of the important elements that you would see being a central element in talent management programs is the development of the leadership competency model that serves as the basis for subsequent talent development programs. Mm-hmm. The thing that struck me as rather interesting and perhaps a bit a potential source of problem is the fact that for at least Malaysian organizations that I studied, many of them ended up actually engaging with a certain consultant. And all of them were using the same leadership competency model. Yeah. Regardless of what industry they were in, what were their strategic issues, what were the strategic imperative behind the talent management programs. And that's what made me think in terms of whether that would actually be the best approach. So during that time, I was also supervising one of my students who was doing her PhD, and we were looking at the experiences of other organizations in other countries. And I think one of the evidence that we came across was the fact that some organizations that attempted to do that, to simply replicate and imitate what other organizations are doing, encountered a lot of problem. Partly because there was no buy-in to the leadership competency model, partly because the imitators don't always understand what the early adopters were actually trying to achieve, and partly because the strategic imperatives between these organizations are very different. For instance, the evidence that we saw was an attempt by one food company in the United States, trying to emulate the leadership competency model of, I believe they were following Procter & Gamble. It was totally a different industry with different considerations.
F&B and FMCGs.
Yeah, yeah, very different. And I also remember as part of the research when we were looking at some of the experiences of other companies, for instance, 3M, they basically went through that whole process of coming up with their own internally developed leadership competency model to try to understand. The other thing that I was also curious, when I look at some of these models, including the one that was adopted, it doesn't really address the issue of strategic leadership competencies. Mm. Now, in spite of the fact that when you look at many of the focus of the talent management programs, it was actually about preparing people for advancement into senior leadership position to become the future CEO, the future VP, the C-suite positions.
Right.
Yet the content of the program itself was pretty much the generic leadership program that, if you look closely, it seems to be more oriented towards preparing people for middle management kind of a role. The kind of a position that you get to in your mid-30s. Whereas most talent management programs are talking about, you know, preparing people for positions that you would probably get in their 40s, GM, VP positions. So I think there was that gap that we need to basically address. And I think because of this, there's a mixed finding in terms of whether the talent management programs that have been initiated by various organizations have really been able to realize the intended objectives.
Right. So, like you just mentioned, and I know you mentioned this in your book as well, you made a distinction between leadership, one being operational leadership and the other being strategic leadership. Maybe you can just walk us through the difference.
Okay. Now, part of the reason why I'm addressing this book is that most people begin their career at the executive level. Mm-hmm. And basically, we are given operational responsibilities, managing operations that tend to have a very short-term targets, you know, goals or tasks that are evaluated or monitored on a weekly basis, monthly basis, or quarterly basis. And because of that, the focus is more about achieving more with the resources that you have. But it usually doesn't involve rethinking what business are you in.
Mm.
If we look at some of the companies that have been able to sustain performance over a long period of time, it is their ability to adapt to the changing environment. If you take, for instance, Fujifilm and compare it with Kodak, for instance, Kodak got stuck into its core business, kept on doing the same thing again and again. They became better at what they were doing, but at a time when the industry was actually changing, moving towards digital photography. And the irony is that Kodak was a company that actually invented digital photography, but they failed to exploit the technology.
Mm.
Fujifilm adapted to the changing environment by actually going into multiple areas. They went into cosmetics. They went into a pharmaceutical product because they discovered that their core technology actually centers around chemistry. Mm. So that kind of a thinking requires strategic thinking. If you're operationally focused, then you become more concerned about doing better what you're currently doing. A strategist is always looking ahead. What's the next challenge that's going to appear on the horizon? Thinking ahead 2 or 3 years down the road in terms of trying to address discontinuities and preparing how to deal with those discontinuities.
Okay, let's just go back to the basics of leadership, Dr. Rosan. What do you feel separates a manager from a real leader?
Okay, I wrote an article on this just a few weeks, was it last month, trying to ask whether there's really a distinction between a manager and a leader. In the past, it was argued that managers are primarily interested in maintaining, more maintenance-oriented, more administratively focused. But I think that distinction is becoming very blurred today because with more organization putting an emphasis on performance, wanting to see results and KPI, even the lowest level employees are now accountable for KPIs.
Mm.
So like it or not, you have to be able to actually stretch your performance, go beyond being maintenance oriented because you're not going to get more by doing the same thing again and again. The difference may well be that leaders have to be responsible for leading people. And I think in that respect, those who rise up the organization would find themselves having to shoulder more leadership responsibilities than those lower in the organization. But even then, it really depends if you are working as an engineer in a chemical plant. Right from day one, you will have subordinates who are already technicians, production operators, for instance. But in some organizations, you may not have subordinates on your first day of work, depending on the nature of the organization.
When we come back, we talk about outdated strategies and methods of leadership that should be completely retired from the workplace. Dr. Rosan Othman will be right back on Enterprise BFM 89.9.
Break from midfield. BFM 89.9.
This is Enterprise with me, Audrey Raj. Dr. Rosan Othman of HumanCap is with us today, and we're discussing strategic leadership competencies. So, Dr. Roshan, what would you consider as the most effective method of leadership across industries? Or are they industry-specific?
I think the important thing to note, when I was addressing the issue of strategic leadership development, I was making that distinction between operational leadership and strategic leadership. And the kind of approach that you rely on when you're developing operational skills are quite different from strategic leadership skills.
Mm.
At the operational level, it tends to be more proceduralized. For instance, you know, a typical lower-level supervisory leadership program or team leadership program will tell you about the 6 steps to delegation, 7 steps for managing your time. You know, everything is very proceduralized. But as you go up in the organization, the challenge is more about stretching your imagination rather than being governed by procedures.
Mm.
Okay, so strategic challenges tend to be ambiguous. A lot of the time when you know that, you sense that there is a threat or a new opportunity emerging, you're not even so sure what those opportunities are, what those threats are. It takes time for you to actually discover. And you're not, even when you know, you're not so sure what are the responses that you should basically rely on. So because of that, strategic leadership requires a lot more anticipatory thinking, a lot more sense-making, a lot more
adaptability.
Imagination, adaptability.
Mm.
And part of the problem why managers cannot make that adjustment is because they continue to think like the procedural, like the operational leaders who think that you can solve problem with 4 steps to do this, 6 steps to do that.
Mm.
Let me share with you one example. I'm aware of one of the GLCs in this country, you know, a very big GLC. They did an assessment some time ago, I think last year, of the members of top management team. And I'm talking about the GM, VP, AGM level upwards. They have about 300 in the whole group. And the finding that they got from that assessment that was that only 10% of the 300 members of top management team are really equipped to lead at the strategic level. Many of them continue to think, operate with the mindset of an operational leader. And I think that makes a big difference. If you're talking about creating an organization that is versatile, that is able to, you know, behave more like a jet fighter, an F-16 rather than a Boeing 747, then you will need leaders who have that, first and foremost, that mental versatility to actually adapt to different situations. I mean, if you look at the history of innovative companies like 3M, mm. 3M started as a mining company, you know, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. But the thing that made them change was the fact that they were able to always look at new technologies, new products that they discover, and looking at how this can fit into the future. They're not trapped by their past. Some companies, on the other hand, can't seem to get out of their current mold. Most people do not realize it, but the first PC was actually developed by Xerox in 1973.
Okay. Yes, I remember it came somewhere in the 70s, but I didn't know it came from Xerox.
Yeah, it came out in the 1973. And even then, you know, most of us started using PC late 70s or early 80s. We were talking about Apple IIe, the early IBM-compatible machines or IBM machines, and the more playful one we would have been Amstrad, you know, those kind of a machine. And for the most part, they were pretty dull, you know, monochrome monitor, you have to write commands.
Mm.
But Xerox had actually, even in 1973, used graphic user interface. They had actually introduced the mouse, the use of icons and all that. The problem was that as a company, they didn't recognize the potential of the technology.
Mm.
Now, when Apple decided to invent the Macintosh, it was actually inspired by what was done in Xerox. In fact, there is a video which shows that the Xerox team was actually invited to a meeting in... the Apple team was invited to a meeting in Xerox. And when they saw it, Steve Jobs was so excited about it. And he went back and said, this is the future of computing and this is what we should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is strategic leadership. you know, the ability to think, to not be trapped by the present, to not be trapped by history, the ability to think in terms of the future, looking at new possibilities. And that's where, as I said, if you are very proceduralized in your thinking, everything has to be governed by strict rules and very strict protocols, then you are less likely to be able to venture out and think along those lines.
Are there other outdated strategies and methods of leadership that you think should be just retired from the workplace?
Actually, if you look at leadership development, the comment I sometimes make to my students, I usually ask them, what does it take for someone to become a leadership consultant? So you get all kinds of answers. You must have MBA, you must have BVA. And I say the reality is that all you need to have is enough money to print yourself a business card saying you're a leadership consultant. That's all. There is no standardization of knowledge. And because of that, the range of topics that is included in leadership is actually very broad. I think going ahead, what we need to look at is a new form of learning experience that is specifically focused on shifting away from just knowledge and more towards changing cognitive pattern and ultimately behavior. So this is why in my book, I focus on four elements in leadership development. One is to create what we call this deliberate practice, where studies have shown that the human being is that we are a creature of habit. And when we are good at something, we like to do what we are good at. But advancement doesn't happen that way. Advancement happens when we learn to do those things that we're not good at. Mm. That's how we become better. Okay, in the field of sports, for instance, athletes or sportsmen that keep on polishing on their strength, they improve by a certain amount, but not by much. But athletes or sportsmen who focus on those areas that they are not particularly good at, they tend to make more substantive leaps in terms of their improvement. Same thing with leadership. If you are an engineer or you are someone from finance and you are just doing what you are good at, then you may improve a bit, but not much. To make that substantial improvement, you have to be able to actually make improvements in new areas. And that's what deliberate practice is all about. Going outside your comfort zone, learning, making mistakes, and learning from that mistake. And to learn from that mistake, that's where one of the important things that has to be incorporated in the learning is the reflective thinking. I think a lot has been said about our learning tradition in Malaysia or maybe Asian society being more rote-focused. Mm. We don't leave room for reflection. Exam questions are designed so that there's only one right answer for one question. You know,
right.
You're not supposed to even discuss or debate.
Yes, just regurgitate.
Regurgitate. And I'm finding it a source of frustration because I'm beginning to see that this phenomena is also evident in postgraduate classes. Mm. Students are not able to discuss ideas.
Question theories.
Right? They cannot even explain. Everything is written like a bullet point, like what they see in the PowerPoint slide. Mm. That's the most that they go. So if you want to talk about improvement, it is about developing the discipline to actually reflect on your own weaknesses, reflecting on the failures. Because the human nature is such that we tend to sometimes succumb to developing emotional responses to failures.
Mm.
Okay, so reflection is supposed to help us basically intellectualize our difficulties, to try to understand the cause-effect relationship between the outcome we desire, why our effort didn't lead to the outcome. So that's the process of reflective learning that has to go hand in hand with deliberate practice. The other thing that has to be also incorporated is, of course, blended learning, the use of multiple methodologies of learning, not just the classroom teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I think, again, this is where I think in Malaysia we are still quite at the early stage. Very few organizations are willing to invest in the long-term development of their employees. If you go and talk to potential clients, Sometimes the response that you get, don't bother us with all of this coaching, mentoring and all that. Just come and deliver training 3 days and go back. That's it. We'll take care of everything. So they expect to be able to actually resolve many of these problems with short-term interventions. And unfortunately, it doesn't always work.
And the fourth one?
What was it that I mentioned? Deliberate practice, reflective learning, blended learning. And part of the blended learning will be experiential learning. Okay. What's the relationship here? That experience has to be one that involves breaking down the learning into small parts that involve classroom learning, let's say for 1 or 2 days. You go back and you apply it, work under a coach or a buddy system, and then you come back, do further learning. So it actually mixes the whole thing, so the experience becomes much richer. Sometimes in some organization, and this is something you are not going to hear members of top management or HR managers admitting it, but some of my former students used to say this to me. Yeah, my company also does job rotation and blended learning, but usually we do that to get rid of people that we don't want. It's not really trying to get rid of people who they don't want. So, okay, you go job rotation, get out of my face. Unfortunately, that's some of the reason why the benefits that is supposed to come out from these learning experiences are not there.
Okay. Dr. Rasan, do you have any stories from organizations who have succeeded by developing the right competencies, like you just mentioned?
Succeeded in terms of developing the right competencies. You see, this is always the dilemma that training managers, HR managers always have. How do you prove that HR leads to improvement in terms of financial performance? And the true answer is that it's not easy to actually prove, because whatever you do in terms of training and development, ultimately the performance is going to be very much specific to the context that the person is going to be working in. It's what we call a tenuous relationship. It's a very lengthy relationship, and for you to say A leads to B directly is a bit difficult. But we do know that the companies that have been at the forefront as far as leadership development, at least we can talk about, even in the United States, we can talk about companies like GE, Procter & Gamble. And we can say in the case of Malaysia, companies like Petronas, for instance, have sort of earned the image, not only in terms of their performance, but have also earned the image something like a talent factory, in the sense that when people go around looking for future talent for their requirements, these are the places that you see people going to recruit.
Right.
Or some of the consulting companies, the McKinsey, the Accenture, they've done a good job as far as training their consultants, and they are highly sought after. So if you want to take that as the sort of a proxy measure of the effect of talent, yes, I would say you can argue that those are evidence that companies that spend more are usually recognized as talent factories, and the industry knows who they are and where you can find their talents.
We're speaking with Dr. Rozhan Othman of HumanCap on strategic leadership competencies. Enterprise will be right back after these short messages. BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back. This is Enterprise with me, Audrey Raj, author of the book Getting Ahead, Developing Competencies for Strategic Leadership. Dr. Rozhan Othman is with us today. Now, the book discusses the difference between operational and strategic leadership roles and explains how managers can develop their strategic leadership competencies. Now, Dr. Rozhan, you've had international exposure throughout your career. What are some of the lessons you've taken home in terms of leadership from Western and Asian work cultures?
I think at the root, the most distinct difference is communication pattern. Asians are, of course, much more reserved, much more subdued. But then again, I must be cautious to not also stereotype and overgeneralize, because Asia starts from the Far East, Korea, Japan, all the way to the Middle East. Mm. And of course, you bring an Arab, you bring a Japanese, you see two very different characters.
Of course, of course.
Same thing with Europeans, for instance. You will see that the Scandinavians are very different from, let's say, the Hispanics, the Mediterranean Europeans. And of course, they are also different from the Aussies and the Americans. So the important thing to always remember is to always understand these nuances in terms of how people communicate and how people actually discuss ideas. In some organizations, people can be very direct and very blunt. But in some organizations, people tend to express their opinion in very subtle manners. And I think being able to understand that can make a big difference as to whether you become an effective leader or you derail right at the beginning of your leadership. Let me show you one example of a Norwegian company that started its operation in Malaysia. I think they opened up a plant in Shah Alam. So they sent this Norwegian manager to become the plant director. And Norwegians, being Scandinavians, are fairly egalitarian in terms of outlook, in terms of behavior, and they're not very status conscious. Mm. So when he came to work, he bought himself an MPV.
Okay.
Okay, as a plant manager. And when he came to work in the MPV, his Malaysian managers were shocked, because to them, the boss must come either in a BMW or Mercedes. Not an
car.
MPV, yeah, something that is really flashy that denotes your status, you know.
Mm.
Probably his subordinates were driving BMW and he's coming here with an MPV. That was unacceptable to the locals. It created a bit of a controversy within the company, and they actually insisted. And finally, to sort of, out of deference to the subordinates, he bought a Volvo. Something that's probably not too flashy, but close
safe.
Enough. Yeah,
safe.
Yeah, and I think that's how the Scandinavians probably think.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
They're less concerned about, you know, speeding down the highway or whatever, and thinking more about safety,
practicality.
Practicality. Yeah. So you see, these different mindsets can make a big difference. And then there are, of course, those sensitive cultural practices. I was talking to some of my students and they were telling me when they look at the habits of Malaysians, and I think generally these Asians in this part of the world, it is considered normal to be spitting around.
Mm.
You know, it can get very disgusting, but it happens. One of my Iranian students said to me that in Iran, if you spit at someone, that's as good as saying, "I'm severing my relationship with you."
Yes.
Okay. And not only that, she was saying to me, even if all you do is to just say, "I will spit at you," that's it. That's the end of your relationship, you know. So imagine a Malaysian manager who's so used to spitting around for whatever reason, he'll go and work in Iran. He's going to damage and burn many bridges there because of his habit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think these are some of the things. You know, we like to think that sometimes the Kuala or the Europeans come here, they're not sensitive about our culture. I think there are no shortage of examples of Malaysians who go overseas, lead local organizations, and are just as sensitive about local culture.
Right.
And there have been major blunders that has happened in the last maybe 10 years.
Among the countries that you've been to, which country you feel developed strategic leadership the most? And maybe which country needs more help in this area?
I think management as a practice has always been one of the areas that the Americans play very much a leadership role in terms of the thinking, in terms of looking at how to compete in a global manner. I also know Japanese companies are beginning to feel the pressure of global competition.
Mm.
Partly because the rise of Korea and China, And partly because the old business model, the old management practice are no longer working. You have to understand that in Japan for a very long time, and even until today, you will see that most companies are led by engineers. Okay, MBA programs are quite new, relatively, compared to even Malaysia or even, and definitely with the United States and Japan. For a long time, the MBA, there are no MBA programs. The business schools are a relatively recent phenomenon in Japan. So because of that, when I went to Japan and discussed with the management of some of the Japanese companies, this whole idea of talent management, strategic leadership competencies, is actually quite new. And what I find to be interesting is that they, because they are new, they are quite prepared to explore new approaches, new possibilities. Some of them have been sending people even to Malaysia for short-term training, cross-cultural induction and learning English as well as trying to learn from looking at how other people manage. It is a challenge because many Japanese organizations in the past, they were primarily focused on the Japanese market. The external market that was really exciting to them was, of course, the United States.
Yeah.
Countries like Malaysia were mainly seen as a low-cost manufacturing base with a small potential. But I think the last 5 years, they've seen that this is fast changing because Europe and the United States, yeah, it is still, these are still strong economies, but the growth rate is becoming slower, which is typical in very developed economies. So a lot of the new growth will happen in
the more
developing countries. So I would imagine that it will become even more interesting in Japan because they struggle to look at it. And I've been working with some of my Japanese counterpart on these issues. They've even invited me to present and conduct some of this training in one of the universities in Japan before this.
Doctor, you just said you conduct training in universities and such, but do you conduct leadership trainings for organizations or larger companies?
Yes. Actually, I've never conducted leadership training in universities because universities, there are so many smart people, so they don't need to be trained. They all think they are leaders.
Okay.
So most of the training that I've done are actually outside the universities.
Right.
And specifically in the last, I think, 2 or 3 years, the focus has been on the strategic leadership competencies.
Mm-hmm.
Because I noticed that's one gap in the market. I mean, leadership training, as I said, there are so many players out there. Single trainer companies as well as big companies, everybody is going into leadership. But when you're talking about strategic leadership competencies, that is a very underserved market. And we've been doing that, I think, since 2015. And our approach was, as I said, to try to incorporate many of these elements like the creating deliberate practice into the learning experience. And we will usually start with a pre-training assessment that will include 360-degree assessment. So that before the when the leaders go through the training, they will know how people around them think of their leadership abilities and leadership skills.
Mm.
So when we are also designing the program, we are able to customize based on the unique profile of the group that we are dealing with. So for human capital development, our approach is to not have a standard program that we use for everyone. But our preferred approach would be to come in and do that assessment first.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we will develop a program that is unique to the client.
And your book, Getting Ahead, heavily covers strategic leadership competencies.
Yes.
Whom would you say would it serve the best? I mean, the lower level, the middle level, senior level, or possibly all levels?
I would think that those who are in the mid to late 30s, managers hoping to advance to senior managers and GM position, that would be most valuable for them. I found that some readers who have not had much of a managerial experience, they have a bit of a problem understanding some of the issues being discussed. They're talking about, you know, strategic positioning, especially those who do not have proper training in terms of management. They may have come from the pure sciences or the pure engineering discipline. So I would argue that those in the mid-30s to 40s, if you're already a manager looking forward to advance to a senior-level position, then that will be the kind of a thing that can help. Now, the other thing is, of course, people who are planning training, I think the book will help them identify new directions that has to be addressed, going beyond the typical training that you would see being available in the market currently.
The book is entitled Getting Ahead by Dr. Rosan Othman. Where can we find this book? Is it out in the bookstores already?
Yeah, it is now in Borders. And of course, you can get it online at Amazon.com as through Google Books. They've been there since late last year. Anybody who's interested can also go to our website, humancap.com.my, and contact our people, and they can actually provide the book straight from the company.
I've been speaking with author of the book Getting Ahead, Developing Competencies for Strategic Leadership, Dr. Rosan Othman. Now, if you miss any part of this interview, don't fret. Just go look for the podcast on the BFM mobile app, available now on the App Store and on Google Play. My name is Audrey Raj. Resource Center is up next after the 11 a.m. news. This is Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.